I'm Mark Gandy for Saville Bookshelf. Why did Walter Chrysler build the Chrysler Building? Now, I'm going to suggest that reason number one was a monument to himself and to have the largest building in New York at the time. That's in the early 1930s. Now then, why did John Jacob Rascub build the Empire State Building around the same time? Now, I'm a huge fan of JJR, as I like to call him. I'm still not certain of the justification for its development at the time. And that leads me to this episode's focus. The book is The Birth of a Building. It's a philosophical and pragmatic approach to how real estate development projects are conceived, financed, designed, and constructed. And I'm curious what Chrysler and Rascub would have thought of this book. Then again, I'm very interested in what our very special guest has to say about this book. And that's coming up next here on CFO Bookshelf. The book is The Birth of a Building by Ben Stevens. The author declined the offer to be interviewed, so I asked a special guest. His name is John Coe, who has been in the real estate industry for more than 30 years. He's the podcast host of Icons of DC Area Real Estate. Now, I met John in the Farnham Street membership community. This guy is mega smart. He's humble, very easy to listen to. The first question I have for John Coe, why do you think I picked this book? What's special about it?
Philosophically, I guess is the word that I'm going to use to start with. The Birth of a Building is the name of the book. So, you know, to me, the real estate process is an organic process. So you're taking a piece of ground and you're trying to put a structure on the building, on the ground. Why do you want to put that structure there? Why? What is the purpose of the project in the first place? What's your mission? So obviously, we all want to have children. Maybe some do, some don't. But we're trying to keep our species going. And I think with buildings, we're trying to create them for a reason. There's usually a purpose behind it. And I look back at early in my career, people were putting up buildings because they were given money to put them up, not necessarily for a use need. Somebody said, "I've got to invest, so why don't you just build a building for me?" You know, and I looked at that and I said, "Wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense." You know,
so this title hit my radar a little over a year ago, and like you, you're probably getting almost every day these recommendations from Amazon. And I'm maybe a little bit of a weirdo. I actually do look at every book, even the ones on fiction. And I saw this title and I just thought, this looks really interesting. I mean, the title, like you, it caught my attention. And if you and I were to get on Amazon right now and key in real estate, I bet you my bottom dollar that the first 100 results would be how to make a lot of money in real estate, how to never right. lose, how to become a multi-billionaire. It's all going to be an investment, but this book is not of that ilk, is it?
No. So before we got on, I used one word that I'm going to try to expand on, and that's the word is mystical. And again, the word means primarily it's kind of an unknown. When you're doing a project in real estate, and I'm thinking about the development of a project, not necessarily the investment or the purchase of an existing building, you don't know what you're going to come up with. It's a process, just like when you have a baby. You don't know what that child's going to end up being. So it's a very similar analogy, I think. So you do everything you can to build the quality, the energy, the effort in the process. and making a building work for everybody takes a lot of time and energy, and there's so many disciplines that go into it. So another word I'll use is multidisciplinary, and that's really what's critical about our industry, real estate industry, is that you bring in skills from literally hundreds of people to pull a project together. And so it's really a team effort to get a property built. No one person can build a building from scratch without help. So it's a real team effort, but it's the same about, you know, we've heard this expression, it takes a village to raise a child. It's the same situation with a building.
What is your expertise in real estate? What has it been? What is it now? What has it been in the past?
Well, I came up in the industry in the institutional investment range. My mother was a real estate broker in residential. And my dad was a retailer, but they bought on the side. They bought single family homes, renovated them, and rented them. So I saw it on the single family side growing up. But I said, you know, that's a consumer business, and I'm more interested in B2B. So I wanted to deal with business people. So I decided that I wanted to study it from an institutional standpoint, started institutional real estate, which I knew was invested in commercial property, mostly multifamily, et cetera. So that was more interesting. And income producing real estate was more interesting to me than buying and owning your residence. So just more fascinating, more business oriented. So that's what really got me into the industry. So I was a finance guy, and I've been a finance guy most of my career. But I did get involved in acquiring property. I did development. I was involved in that process. But as a finance guy, it's to me the most generalist of all the things, because you have to know everything about the industry,
right,
to finance it. You really do. You have to know all the aspects, and you're a finance guy, so you know what I mean. It's, you have to know all the intricacies of everything, because the way I look at it is money is the oil or the energy behind the project. If you didn't have the money, you couldn't have anything done. You couldn't get anything done. So it's kind of like filling up the gas tank with a car, is putting the cash in the deal. So that's kind of the way I look at it. And that's why the multidisciplinary aspect is good. So this book really goes into, it starts out with this whole birds and the bees process, as he puts it, in the part one. And then he gets into the timeline of a project, which I think is great, the development process, because understanding how you get a building built and all the players involved, and he puts all the elements into it.
The reason I asked you about your background, I'm curious, again, you're an expert. You are an expert in this field. You know this field like the back of your hand. You're probably going to tell me over coffee, I'm still learning something new every day. Did you gain a lot of value from this book based on your background?
It's one of those step back books. So you kind of step back and look at it from a different perspective. In real estate, when you're learning it, you're learning the nuts and bolts of how to put a deal together. So value equals income over rate, and all those formulas that you learn, and you understand the highest and best use of property. You understand the three types of value. There's the cost approach, the income approach, and the market data approach, comparison and appraisal, and all those things. Those are the nuts and bolts. But you step back and you look at why. What is the purpose of this? You know, what you got to answer that question, because if you're not answering that question, nothing makes any sense. I don't think, you know. It's like having a bunch of nuts and bolts on the floor. Unless you're putting something together that you can see conceptually, it doesn't make any sense. So to me, you got to ask the questions, why are we doing this? What's the purpose of it? And then it kind of all comes together as a big part. And that's the way it was, you know, birth, the analogy of birth again gets into the complication of the process. But I like to cut it back into simple step-by-step processes that over time build something a little bit more sophisticated and complicated.
Here's what is interesting. The author does not have your background. Were you surprised to read the general biography of the author?
We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yes and no. I think, you know, he has a philosophical approach to real estate. And I think that's, if I were to, and I do teach and I do mentor young people. In fact, I have a community of 65 young people that I oversee, you know, don't oversee them, but I guide them, I help them, I enable them, I try to promote their interest. But I bring in this multidisciplinary approach to thinking so that you are always wondering, you know, is this the right thing? And ask yourself all the time, am I doing the right thing? Am I making the thing right? And that's way he kind of, in this book, he kind of focuses on, you know, the metaphysical aspect of real estate. it's different.
He did not go to business school. I think he has a degree in, was it divinity? And so he took a lot of philosophy courses. So He definitely has a different lens of when he approaches this topic. Like you said, he approaches it philosophically. So again, that's another reason this book I find provocative, because he's not a finance guy. He's looking at this from a different perspective. I'll say this, my favorite part of the book is part one. I think even just the casual finance person, this would have been the perfect primer for finance. I mean, he's broken down finance in such a way that I think almost any high school student could figure this out. He talks about the numerator. He talks about the denominator. So I loved, and you use the word, by the way, I hope I'm not distracting you. I'm taking notes as you speak. You called this a step back book. And that's a perfect way to look at, especially that first section. I want to share with you real quickly, and I'm gonna have some specific questions for you. Here's my opinion about the birth of a building. And I'm from the same state. In fact, I grew up one county away from the legendary Sam Walton. There's a story, and I found out it's true. He saved a young boy's life from drowning. Sam Walton was an Eagle Scout, and I can pretty much tell you exactly where that location was. He just down the about 2 miles from where I live. He went to University of Missouri at Columbia, which is just, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump from where I live. So people tend to know in this neighborhood who Sam Walton was, especially people, baby boomers like me. And there's a story. It's, you can read between the lines in the book, but it's not in his book, but there's a story that he'd be flying and he says, we're going to put a Walmart there, or we're going to put a Walmart there. And what's unique about that is he'd say, we're going to put it there where there's nothing there. There's no major highways. But what would eventually happen, highways would end up near that new Walmart. And not everyone can be a Sam Walton in real estate. So my big confusion part about development, real estate development, is getting it right, figuring out what's the right demand, because this project that you have in your head may not get realized. It may not be built until 5-6 years later. Maybe you're on a fast track 2 years, but you have to know the demand out, and then it's got to get right, the design part of it. Am I on the right track? Am I right that that's one of the hardest parts about, it's not the financing, but getting the product right for the market?
Well, it's an organic process. I mean, you start with a big picture idea of why you're building it. You know, I mean, in Sam Walton's case, he knew he had to distribute his merchandise to a certain geography radius. Typically, retailers look at it on a radius analysis. Right. So where is he building his store? You know, how wide is his net as far as, you know, people and, you know, how he's doing it? He looked at things differently than almost any other retailer, because he started in the rural markets instead of starting in the big cities. So he found a gap in the marketplace, and he's about as bottom up in the real estate industry as anyone in history, I think, in our country.
Interesting. That's interesting.
Most people look in urban markets to start and look at the highest density to build to, as opposed to the most scattered. And he, probably growing up in a rural environment, he said, we're way underserved here in the rural environment, so we need to figure this out.
Well, let me tell you, in the time we have left, here's how I want to unpack this book. This is a little mini book club between us two that other people are getting to hear. The book is broken up, and it's the Big Eight. Speaking of the University of Missouri, that college used to be in what used to be called the Big Eight. And I remember as a young accounting pup, when my teachers would keep talking the Big Eight, I'm thinking, what does this have to do with our basketball conference? And it's like they were talking about the Big Eight accounting firms. That's how much of a hick I was. So his Big Eight, we don't have time to go through all eight. I'll just rattle them off quickly. He's broken the book up into forecasting, land, design is number three, approvals, entity formation, financing, construction, and opening. It's really seven, but he threw in opening. Maybe he wanted the Big Eight. So we don't have time to go through all those. What I wanted to do is spend the rest of the time. I have five questions for you, and then I'm going to leave it up to you to share some of your big ideas. The reason I get questions and you get to throw out the big ideas because I'm the one who has the pea-sized brain between the two of us. So that's why I'm asking the questions instead of sharing your laughing. So question number one, and you can guess we're going to focus more on the financing and the forecasting part of the book. But question number one, the time and expense to vet a project. I wrote that in my notes. But here's my question, and this is why I love having you on the show, because you've been this institutional investor for years. How many of these deals do you need to vet until you get that one? Is it 100? Is it 50? 200 just feels too long. You know, you're in the Farnham Street community. I think there's this concept, this mental model of thinking of in extremes. One extreme is three projects, and another extreme is 200. So it's got to be somewhere in the middle. How many projects do you vet before you can say, this is the one we're doing?
It can be between 50 and 100, depending on
That's
the situation.
A lot. That's a ton.
Yeah, it is a ton. But you the 48 of them, you'll quickly call. To the, you know, the first phone call, the first view, you know, we used to get broker packages in that had, you know, two or three pages in, and you knew immediately that the sponsor wasn't sophisticated enough to do what they want to try to accomplish. They didn't understand what they needed to present. Sometimes they'd come in with something that's so sketchy that you didn't know, but you knew there was a good location. You said, wait a minute, there's more here. So you'd want to know more. Other times you just say, nah, this is inconceivable. So you try to do that on 75% of what you look at right up front. And then once you get to that level, then you dig a little deeper. You might go the next level. You might do a preliminary underwriting and say, okay, well, this is marginal. So let's dig a little further. And you have to go through probably three or four layers before you get to the point of a deal that makes sense to start underwriting and really digging into and that. So you try to cut away the fat, as I say, as quickly as you can in the process right up front. So that it can be 50 deals, but if people know who you are and what you want to do, it narrows that down dramatically. So, if you know people that bring you deals more than once, you'll know real quick whether that's somebody that you want to deal with or not. So that's another part of it.
This is an unrealistic question because I know you always have something on your plate, but let's assume you had nothing on your plate. That's the unrealistic part of this question. And let's say now you're looking at 50. You go from 50 to about a dozen, those dozen to three or four. Now you're down to one. Is that a time span of maybe 9 months, 6 months, a little bit longer?
Oh, no. Less than 30 days. I was in mortgage banking most of my career, so that in the finance, you've got to do, 10 to 15 deals a year, unless you're doing humongous deals that take tremendous amounts of time. To make a living, you got to do 8 to 10 deals a year. Most mortgage bankers make, low to mid six figures. You got to do 10 to 15 deals a year to make that work. In the institutional side, it may be fewer than that, depending on the scale of what you're working on. So if you're doing a regional mall development, that's a whole different game than doing a 50,000 square foot industrial building. So it's just a whole different, it depends on what you're doing and the scale of what you're doing it in. But, sometimes it takes more time to do $1 million deal than it does to do $100 million deal. So it just depends on the sponsor, how capable they are, and how easy it is to get done.
I would make one exception unless you're working on a Bass Pro. I can tell you when the mic is turned off how long it takes to get a Bass Pro built. It is a lot. It's about a 2-year project because I've been involved in the front end of one. And it's like holy yeah. Cow. Question number two. So there's I forget what it's called. I don't know if it's called the master format. But when you're doing your budget in that construction master format that has about 15, 16, or 12 categories, I don't have the book open.
But you're talking about a development budget?
Yes. I would think that part of the budget would be the most nerve-wracking. How often do you even come close to getting that budget right in terms of the construction?
There's several components of that. So there's the cost component. So the development costs of the project, so the land, the hard costs and the soft costs part of the budget. And then that has nothing to do with the income side. That's purely just the cost of getting the project built physically. Then there's the income side, and that's where you have to forecast what the rents are going to be and what it's going to cost to operate the property. That's a whole different component of the forecasting of a development project. So what's really mystical in some respects is to be able to forecast usually use a 10-year projection on the income, and then you've got to calculate based on the costs that you think the project's going to cost to build, and that includes soft costs, which include financing and everything else. You do a formula based on the net operating income you create in the first stabilized year of that property by the total costs of the project, and there's a metric there to whether the project is feasible or not. And that's usually, today it's around 6% on a multifamily project, which 2 years ago would be 3%, half that, 3 to 4, maybe four. Actually, no, I take that back, 4.5 to 5. On
that's not a lot of margin for error.
No, and we've seen costs change dramatically in supplies on the hard side. And of course, interest rates are the biggest variable and on the soft side. So that destroys a project overnight, is that interest rates going up can just that makes a deal that you thought was going to work instantly not going to work.
I think the way you should have answered this question, John, is I started out by saying this part of the budget is nerve wracking. I think he should have come back and said, Mark, it is nerve wracking. Okay. Well, that segues to my next question. It has to do with land. And this is in the second part of the book where he's going through his big eight. So he starts with forecasting, then he gets into land. I found this interesting. He says, handle the inflexible parts first. That's the entire project, the cost. Handle the inflexible parts first, then solve what can be spent on the rest. And he goes, and you're nodding your head. He goes on to say, land must remain the most flexible the most flexible the longest. I want to repeat that one more time so everyone will grasp this. Land must remain the most flexible the longest. Okay, Mr. Real Estate Expert, why? Why is that?
The most variability that we see is in the land because it's the root of location. So you could go out in the middle of Kansas and find a site and build a 50-story office building, but there's no demand there. Nobody's going to go. You can go in downtown Washington in the CBD, at least you could have a few years ago before the pandemic, and build a trophy office building, and you're going to have tremendous demand. So the land underneath that building is going to be worth a tremendous amount because there's a significant demand. So you need to understand the market demand for something before you really evaluate the land value. And that's really and we always said location, location, location. Well, that's the reason why. It's just the underlying value of the land underneath is the critical piece. Now that's changed, and it's changing every time. The pandemic sent a shockwave through our industry, and we still haven't figured it out yet. I mean, it was an explosion that caused way, way too many second order consequences, things that just are still being filtered. That's why I'm looking at some crises, and what used to be very stable markets are no longer stable.
Well, you called this at the outset a step back book, and this comment about land, I just thought, I can't wait to ask John about this line in the book. I never heard anyone write it quite like this when it comes to the land component. I'm going to skip on near the end of his big eight. I will say this for the non-practitioner, the chapter on design was short, but I found it very interesting. And again, he's coming from this philosophical standpoint. So I love the little section on design. He even talks about what's called creative tension. And that came up in a book. I interviewed the author who wrote about Benjamin Guggenheim, who was really, Benjamin Guggenheim was behind the construction of that Guggenheim Museum there in New York. And I'm not going to say his name, you can, but he dealt with the architect that this author brings up. And on creative tension, I completely get it. So, but I'm going to skip that and go on to financing. In financing, he talks about what's called the finance stack. It's usually going to start out with you. You're going to find some investors, and then the bank is going to be the remainder. My question is, with institutional investors or institutional investing, the equity component, what percentage typically makes up of third party investors?
Typically it's, the ownership is usually struck between the sponsor and the third party investors. Usually it's a limited partnership structure in LLC. And it's typically anywhere between 90-10 sometimes, or 80-20. So it can be 10% ownership of the owner or the sponsor, 90% of the third-party investors is the typical. And sometimes it goes up to 20-80. And then rarely when you have an institutional sponsor, you go as high as 50-50. But that's very rare. And that's where somebody like a big corporation like a, I don't know, a manufacturer wants to build a building. He can't do everything. He didn't want to put all his eggs in one basket.
Right.
So he might go borrow from an equity. He'll get to find a partner to put in half the equity. And normally those are financed very conservatively because it's a single user. And usually it's based on the credit of the company that's behind it. But in a traditional multifamily project, it's 90-10 is the ratio, and it's raised as, you know, smaller deals or friends and family. So it's, you know, you go and pass the hat at the country club.
Right.
Or it goes to the institutional level. There are family offices that invest in certain sizes, and then you go up the next level and you get into the institutional market where you raise pension fund money and or
insurance,
life insurance companies. Etc.
And that may sound like, and John, that may sound like an overly simplistic question. If I have one little nitpick in the book, when he talks about the equity investors, he did not spend a lot of time talking about, oh, here is your option for equity or, excuse me, institutionalized investors like you are describing. That does not come up. He just kind of glossed over that. And it's like, okay, well, who are these? Where are you going to find these equity investors? So that part was just a little bit glossed over. So that's why I asked.
I wouldn't expect him in this book to do that.
Okay.
Because there are whole books written about that process, that the capital stack, as they call it.
Fair point.
So, I mean, there's a whole courses in college.
Construction is, I think, the seventh of the eighth, the big eight of his topics. And so he does divide out construction into the major groups. And just that master format, I like being able to refer to that. In fact, I will always go back to that on other projects of even clients my own, where we may be building a new warehouse, a new distribution center. It's a handy list to have. I mean, I know you can Google it, but he's got it very succinctly in his book. Here's my question again. For you, because you've been doing this for a while, I have experienced them. You have. There are what I call the horror stories of construction, and it can be near the beginning. It can be near the middle. It can even be near the end. You have to live with those. Are there any horror stories that just come to mind that you'll never forget that make for good storytelling? What's your favorite?
One of my first apartment development deals. This was with a company known as Winchester Homes, which was a division of Weyerhaeuser, which is a big lumber manufacturer out of the Northwest. Well, this is a home builder here in the Washington, D.C. area. They had not built apartments. They were mostly a home builder and a townhouse developer, so selling to consumers. This was, their first apartment. Garden apartment project over a large tract. And I was not sophisticated enough and we went out monthly to do inspections on the project. So they started building buildings on the project. And then suddenly the inspector who had been doing inspections for many, many years said, "So let's look at your stormwater management plan and see how this is working out here on getting that done." Well, it turns out they didn't start the stormwater management of the project at the right time.
Oops.
So they had to tear down the buildings that they'd already built to re-engineer the site management.
At their expense?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it almost cost the project manager his job. He was fortunate.
Oh, you think? It didn't?
Yeah.
You know, that is the type of project, depending on the size of the project, that's almost the type of mistake that could send a contractor into bankruptcy. I don't know. I'd be curious to know how they pulled that off.
Well, and it's a 380 unit apartment project. It wasn't a small job.
What a mistake. Well, the good news is that horror story, the big problem for you guys on the other end, you lost time. And lost time means lost income. Okay, well, those are my Fab Five questions out of the book for you.
Sure.
Let's hear from you, John. Take your time. Let's hear from you. What are some of the big ideas you've pulled from this book?
So I mentioned it before, but I find it a mystical way of approaching the real estate industry. And just he takes a philosophical approach, a layman's approach, but it's layman's approach, but yet he gets into some details. He did his homework on some of the nuts and bolts. So he goes into, as you elaborated a little bit on that, the big eight, as you'd say, all the different effort, the processes in projects. So the market analysis piece, the understanding all the components of the property, the land, the building, the process, the financing. It's good, but he didn't do it in a way that is overly academic, if you know what I'm saying.
I mean, I read it from cover to cover.
It's not a textbook.
No.
Right. But there's enough graphics and enough mathematics to give you the basic concepts. And if you're looking for a high level overview of our industry, it's about as good as I've read, frankly. And that I hope is a compliment to the author, because I've read a lot of books, but I want to cite three books that we'll talk about, we can get into, but I don't know if we have enough time.
You told me you're going to mention three books. I've got to hear them.
Okay. The first one is called The Real Estate Game. And this was by a Harvard business professor by the name of Bill Porvoo, P-O-O-R-V-U. And this makes the entire process of real estate development a game. And he sets game, almost as if you're reading a Monopoly instructions, the game, how to do a board game in real estate. And it's really a good book and it encapsulates the process as if you're playing a game. And of course, the end product is the finished building.
Is it easy to read for, again, I consider myself an outsider. Is it easy for us to read?
A layman can read this book without too much difficulty.
Okay.
Real Estate Game, because it gets your interest enough. And you might have a thesaurus next to you, or you may have to go on Google to check on some terminology, but I think he explains it pretty well in the book. He's a professor of real estate at Harvard Business School. So,
excellent. Love it.
Case study kind of guy, So you can see it in the cases that they build in. And I think he puts cases in the book as a matter of fact.
Okay. Number two,
the next
John.
Next book is called Rethinking Real Estate by Dror, D-R-O-R, Poleg, P-O-L-E-G. And he's a blogger, but he wrote a book. It's about 3-4 years old. That's very fresh on looking at real estate. And this was done before the pandemic, but he anticipated things that were going to come out that actually came out of the pandemic. He was very prescient in his, view of today's real estate markets. So he puts a lot of ideas in there to think about our industry and sector of the industry, office, retail, industrial, multifamily, and what aspects and things to look at, trends to think about. And as the pandemic unfolded, it really drilled down on things that, bigger picture things about our industry. So that was a really good book. That one, I think you probably should be in the business get it. But I think anybody can read it, but they can take their takeaways from it. And then the final book is one that I just finished just 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to be interviewing the author here in my podcast later this month. And the book is called Lay Deal, L-E-D-E-A-L. And this is about a gentleman, and this is a storybook. So it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be a real estate expert to read this book. But it's a story of a guy who, in the late 1980s, built a spectacular building in downtown Washington called the Warner Theater Building, which was, at the time, a $200 to $300 million deal. And back in 1989, 90, that was a huge deal. And it's a spectacular project. I've been to the theater there. It really is a beautiful, and they did the lobby was spectacular. His partner was a guy named Joey Kempfer. His name is Byrne Murphy. He then, everything craters in 1991. And then he goes to Europe. And they had invested in a company called MacArthur Glenn, which is an outlets retail developer here in Washington, in the United States. They took the concept to Europe. They said, we're going to try and make this happen in Europe. So that he started in France to find a rural location in France to build this outlet center. Brand new concept to Europeans. They had never seen anything like it. And he goes through the laborious process of getting a project approved in a foreign country. And every country that he went to, and he went to six different countries, that the process was completely different because of the culture and the way they did business in each of those countries. And it varied within the countries too. So he'd start in Paris, but then he'd go out in the countryside in France. And he said it was completely different to deal with. So anyway, it's a marvelous story. It's a page turner that you can read in probably two, three days. He's a Harvard grad, went to Darden, UVA, MBA school, but he writes extremely well for a real estate guy.
I'm definitely going to read it and the real estate game. and we'll include Rethinking Real Estate. We'll have that in the show notes. Man, those are three great titles. So you mentioned this book is mystical. I think I happen to know that you have two other ideas that you want to throw at this book.
I want to quote myself, if you don't mind.
Please quote yourself.
Okay, so the question that was asked, and this is on Farnham Street, what do you consider beautiful in your field of work or passion? Which I think is a great question. And this is what I said. As a real estate professional, what astounds me is how basic to human existence that place, quote unquote, plays in our lives. Where we are is our context for what we do. Relating to our basic needs, the real estate industry provides places for every human activity and the complexities of how those properties are created from raw land is fascinating. So many disciplines integrate to create every land use from a septic field to a spectacular cathedral. Look around you when walking in an urban environment and realize how much energy goes into every structure and how it either melds in, stands out, or needs to change. The multidisciplinary aspects of business also turn me on. How developers orchestrate attorneys, architects, engineers, investors, lenders, leasing agents, property managers, tenants, customers, vendors, city officials, neighborhood leaders, politicians, and every person who even looks at a property is amazing to me. In some ways, it's almost metaphysical or beyond reason.
You also say this book, and you've already have inferred it, but you start out with saying this book is mystical, but you also believe this book is very simple. That means all of us, even I, can grasp this book, and the book is thorough. I mean,
yes, it's thorough because it's thorough, but it's high level and it's multidisciplinary. If as a developer, you can't know the details of everything, but you've got to know enough, the big ideas, as they say, about each of these things to understand it. And I use for my community a speech by a guy by the name of Peter Kaufman, who Farnham Street kind of falls on. He wrote Poor Charlie's Almanac about Charlie Munger. It's called the multidisciplinary approach to thinking. So I teach those aspects to the, and it's one of the best speeches I've ever heard. So I'd highly recommend it.
So one of the final questions on this book, I'm going to put you on the spot, John, and it sounds like you are up for the task. Let's use the Amazon 5-star rating. I know it's not a 3-star book. I'm curious, is this a 4-star book or a 5-star book for you?
Four to 4.5, probably.
I was going to say, why can't there be 4.25 or 4.5? five would be like, I mean, we know what the 5-star books are out there. I mean, for Shoe Dog is like a 10 on a 5 scale. What a fun book that is. So I'm not ready to put his book at a 5, but it's unique. It's a valuable book. It's interesting. It's sticky. It's a book I don't mind sharing. So I love your rating somewhere between 4 and 5. And I would say the same thing. Before we wrap up, again, this has been great. I picked the perfect person to go through this book with. And by the way, I hope we get to do that. I need an excuse to do this again. Tell me just a little bit about John Coe. Tell me about your podcast. By the way, how many episodes have you now done?
We've done 81. I'm about to put 82 out this week.
Do you do weekly or bi-weekly?
No, it's about every other week, but sometimes I skip. It's every 2 to 3 weeks, let's say. I've been doing it 3.5 years now. I interview primarily Washington, D.C. area leaders in the real estate sector, and that's in all the different disciplines as much as I can diversify to. So developers, the brokers, operators, architects, engineers, the whole gamut I try to cover because they all come at it differently, of course. And what I've built to some extent looking at it is kind of a historic basics of the real estate industry in our market in DC. So eventually if I can get to it, I'd like to write a book someday about it. So we'll see.
Do you have people outside of Washington that will, hey, this is interesting. Maybe people from California, yeah. Texas. That's what I thought.
Yeah. I mean, the conversations are primarily biographies of the people that I interview. So, you know, I get to their origin story and then I go up all the way through because I want to find the thread that makes them successful. That's really what I'm trying to get to. So it's less about real estate per se. It's more about how they became successful in our industry. And then we talk about how that integrates with the industry and how they're involved. But to me, and as everybody has said, you know, people are 99% of our business, you know.
Understood.
You got to find the right people to get things done.
Who is one person, dead or alive? Obviously, if dead, you wish you could have. Dead or alive, who would you love or have loved to have interviewed if they would have said yes, no matter what?
Well, there's a guy I've been pining for now for three, well, since I began the Pines podcast. He keeps putting me off, but his name is Phil Mudd, and he's mid-80s right now, and he's still cranking deals, and he's with Cushman & Wakefield. I would love to have him on because he's been doing business in our industry since the 1980s. He started at the same company I did at Prudential. Actually, he might have been with another life company, but his longest-term relationship was with Prudential, but he did what I did, mortgage bank, mortgage brokerage. So he's the guy that I kind of look up to as been one of the most successful people, and he knew everybody. So that's the guy that I kind of pine for still.
Even though I don't know your space that well, the person I would want to interview, and he's still living, and I have one of his books and I have watched his masterclass, that's Frank Gehry. I would love to interview him. And
his architecture is bizarre.
It is bizarre. I would mainly just the business aspect, because even in one of his books, he talks about the early, I mean, it was him and his wife. And then he brings on his third person and he even talks about a cash flow, but the life of an architect, that is a difficult gig. It's hard. Yes. Going from one person to maybe that regional firm. And then now we're talking going global. that's like a 1 in 1,000 chance or even more. But yeah, he's an interesting individual. By the way, did we say the name of your show? What's the name of your show, John?
No, it's called Icons of DC Area Real Estate.
Got it.
It's on all the podcasts.
So I know you're a reader. Do we get to hear some of your favorite books?
Well, I gave you 3 real estate books. I'm reading a book by Peter Attia right now, which he's a doctor. It's called Outlive. So I'm 69, almost 69 years
old. You're young. You're a kid.
And this book is about longevity, but not just longevity, but health span. So not only living a long life, but a life that's healthy. And so, I mean, that's, you know, to live to be in your 90s and still being able to squat and do exercises and be strong and also have your mental capacity. That to me is a big goal of mine now. So I want to read that. And so that's something that's on my mind. I'm also getting back into the religious spiritual side of my life as well, a little bit more. So you and I know we've shared that you're a big C.S. Lewis fan. So getting back into that a little bit, I'm a little broader in my religious pursuits than just Christianity. So I'm learning about other religions as well. And there's a series that I'll recommend that I'm listening to. It's called the Meaning Crisis by the fellow by the name of John Vervaeke, Vervaeke. It's a series of 51 YouTube videos, and he's a professor at the University of Toronto. It's a spectacular series about meaning.
I'm going to prime the pump a little bit since you're in real estate. I read The Power Broker last year, and I'm keeping my opinion to myself. A lot of the people in Farnham Street, I bet 50% of the members in Farnham Street have read The Power Broker. Like it, don't like it, or in between?
I haven't read it, to be
honest. Oh, you haven't read it? Interesting.
No, I haven't read it. I've read enough about it. You know, I've read Jane Jacobs' book, which was the counter to that book. And she was his arch enemy, vice versa.
That's right.
So, yeah, she was the Greenwich Village preservations lady back in the early 60s. And she's probably the reason why New York is a walkable city, as much of a walkable city as it is, to keep it that way. Because Moses wanted to carve the city up into freeways and really keep everybody in the car instead of thinking about it, walkability. So that was the key theme with Moses. The other book by Robert Caro that I, you know, eventually want to read and people have gotten into is LBJ's biography, which is just apparently unbelievable.
Is that a trilogy or is there a fourth book in the series?
He's working on a fifth book.
Oh, a fifth book.
A fifth book.
I
which is each of them are 800 pages plus. So he's got, I don't know how you can write about a human being that much, but you talk about details. I mean, he probably knows what he did, you know, when he was a baby.
When he started book one, him and his wife went to Texas to live.
Oh, you have to.
So he talked about total immersion into his subject matter. So, well, John, we need to wrap this up. You are,
yes,
A, you're smart. B, you're so gracious. And I've enjoyed every minute of this. And again, I'm sorry if I was distracting. I was taking notes as you were talking, but you are an outstanding person. Thank you for doing this book review with me.
It's been fun. Thank you very much.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
One more time, John Coe, thank you very much. His podcast, Icons of DC Area Real Estate. You can find it wherever you are listening to this podcast. Again, the book we reviewed, The Birth of a Building from Conception to Delivery by Ben Stevens. The composite rating so far at Amazon, 4.7 stars on not quite 200 ratings. If I can go down just one small rabbit trail, we won't go too deep. We are talking about Robert Caro near the end. He's the author of The Power Broker, and the book I would encourage you, well, that's a strong word. If you are maybe thinking about The Power Broker and the LBJ series, but not sure you want to invest that many hours into reading or listening, I would just read Working. It is not a memoir. It's kind of like a Stephen King book where he talks about writing. So Robert Caro, he talks about really behind the scenes of what he had to do to get started researching and then writing about The Power Broker, Robert Moses. And then he talks about his trip to Texas for, I think, 2 or 3 years with his wife. So if you don't want to invest the time to read or listen to The Power Broker or the LBJ series, Working may be an option for you. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.